NBR Radio presents Sunday Business with Andrew Patterson.
Hello and welcome to episode 18 of Sunday Business on NBR Radio. Each week we bring you the very best of the business week, including news, views and interviews with those making the headlines and those hoping to do so in the future. So thanks for taking the time to join us. And my featured guest is New Zealand Initiative Executive Director Dr. Oliver Hartvich. While there's been plenty of focus this week on the implications of Brexit for Britain, where does this leave the European Union and what of its future? That's all to come in this edition of Sunday Business. Well, Britain's shock decision to leave the European Union initially targeted a wave of volatility on financial markets once it became apparent that the leave vote, against all odds, had been successful. However, a week on, and you'd be forgiven for wondering what all the fuss was about, as markets quickly changed course once the initial panic had subsided and investors reflected on the likelihood of interest rates remaining lower for longer. But what of the political implications for the European Union and the risk that Britain's decision to leave may trigger other member countries to consider pulling out? Is Britain's great political achievement of economic unity now at risk of falling apart in the wake of the Brexit vote? Well, this week I spoke to New Zealand Initiative Executive Director Dr. Oliver Hartvich, who has worked extensively in Europe, and began by asking him if the result of the vote had surprised him.
Well, first of all, I didn't really find it that surprising. That's the result I really expected, because the opinion polls had always been very close. But I expected that, just like last year's general election, there would be plenty of shy Brexiteers, such as there were shy Tories in last year's election. And of course, this was always going to be a referendum decided on turnout. So I think that the older voters were likely to turn out was always something that wasn't really factored in. So I wasn't really surprised when it happened. But as it turned out, markets were. And because they hadn't priced it in properly, that's why we saw these turmoil in markets, roller coaster on the stock market and the massive correction in sterling. Now that the dust is finally settling on that, I think we are only just about to realize what it really means for British domestic politics and what it will mean for the EU long term.
And when we think about that, the case for staying in the EU was always that leaving would ruin the British economy. And this, of course, assumed that staying in a broken union would help the economy. There seemed to be a misalignment of that logic, wasn't there?
Yes, and as I argue in my column in the NBR this week, I think when it comes to the great achievements of the European Union, if you're looking closely at them, you will actually realize they are not really achievements of the European Union. They are achievements of the European Economic Community. So the predecessor project. The predecessor project was all about establishing the single market, a common market for the whole of Europe, for the free movement of trade, goods, of services, of people and of capital. Now, all of that was basically in place in the early 1990s. What has happened since is, of course, that the European Union has replaced the European Economic Community. So a political project has replaced an economic one. And I think it is this political union, first and foremost, that the British have revolted against. If you look at post-referendum polls asking people, why did you vote for Brexit? The number one reason they give you is that they wanted to re-establish parliamentary sovereignty. They basically said, we want to have decisions affecting Britain taken in Westminster and not in Brussels. So I think it was a revolt not so much against the blessings of the common market, because nobody would dispute them. It was really a revolt against Brussels, against the power grab from Brussels. It was a revolt against anonymous decision-making. So now we have to find a way to basically keep these achievements of the European Economic Community alive, the access to the single market, while taking Britain out of the political union that it never really wanted to join.
So let's take the two key issues, obviously sovereignty and immigration, but just focusing for a minute on sovereignty, that was key to this decision. How much is that, do you think, going to become a feature of the logic for the rest of Europe now?
Well, there are certainly Eurosceptical movements in other parts of Europe, and I would argue that the British are by no means the most Eurosceptical country in Europe. There is certainly a lot of Euroscepticism on the continent as well. Just look at France, look at even Germany. The future of this kind of Euroscepticism that we find in continental Europe will depend on how the European Union is now handling Brexit and what lessons it takes from that. I'm not very hopeful, actually, that the lessons have been properly understood in Brussels. If you look at the first comments we got from Jean-Claude Juncker, Juncker, the President of the European Commission, or for Martin Schulz, the President of the European Parliament, their immediate response to Brexit was, okay, now we must integrate Europe even further, we must deepen integration, we must proceed with a European project. Well, if that's the response from two of Europe's leading politicians, it only shows you they haven't really understood the lessons at all, because that was exactly the kind of policy that was rejected by the British in the referendum. They did not want this political integration. They did not want unaccountable bureaucrats in Brussels making decisions for Britain. If the European Union doesn't realize that they don't really have a popular mandate for this kind of decision-making, then the European Union is actually doomed. But it just continues a tradition of ignoring what people actually said in referenda. Go back 10 years and you have a look at the Dutch referendum and the French referendum on the European Constitution. Well, both countries rejected the European Constitution, and the European Union just ignored the vote, relabeled the Constitution, the Lisbon Treaty, and proceeded regardless. Then it was put to the Irish. The Irish rejected it. They had to vote again until they accepted it. So the European Union is never very good at actually listening to people and upholding democratic values that it always, of course, confesses to hold in public, but it doesn't really live by its own values.
So do you believe that this decision is only going to embolden Eurosceptics?
Well, as I said, it very much depends on the behavior that we're going to get from the European Union, but the initial reactions we got out of the European Commission and out of the European Parliament were not very encouraging in that respect. I think they haven't properly understood what it means that a country like Britain, one of the larger European countries, is now turning its back on the European Union. They just want to pretend this can still be business as usual, when in fact what is really needed for the European Union to survive and to regain the acceptance of European peoples, it would actually need a massive reform of the European structures.
And that's key to it. Is that going to become part of a parcel of remedies required? What else do you think is it's going to require to begin to, I guess, create this vision for Europe that was always the basis for the European Union from the outset?
Well, I think what it really requires is a rethink on the nature of the European Union. And to go back into history, I mean, initially there were two organizations. There was the European Economic Community and there was the European Free Trade Association. Now, one was a political project with political ambitions, and the other one was just focused on trade. I think it is time to realize that for a lot of the countries that are currently part of the European Union, political union is not really what they want. It is actually the trade, the common market access, that they really care for, but they are not really keen to really become part of a European superstate or a federalist Europe. They would actually like to remain nation states while retaining access to the common market. Well, if that's the case, then really there should be two organizations, and they should be working together. One organization that will actually facilitate the closer integration of some of the European Union members that really want it, and another organization that stands outside that core group of European Union members, maintaining access to the European common market, perhaps accepting maybe some limited degree of internal migration from other European countries, but not participating in any forms of political cooperation, really standing outside and just playing an economic role within the European context. So I think Europe will have to find a different structure that is suited to different interests of different member states.
So the aspect of the union that obviously is its most positive feature is trade, as you've mentioned. And then the flip side of that is immigration. Are they mutually exclusive?
Well, it is possible to square that circle. I mean, the problem is actually, as Britain is now going to negotiate with the European Union on the conditions of Brexit, we have two seemingly irreconcilable aspects colliding. Britain would like to maintain access to the single market. The European Union says, well, you can have that, but you would have to accept the free movement of people, because that's very much part of it. That's one of the four freedoms of the single market, the free movement of people. Now, you cannot have one without the other. That's the argument that we hear from Brussels. I think you probably could have kind of a compromise between these three positions by saying, well, we can have access to the common market. We can have access for capital, for goods, for services, and we accept in return that there will be limited freedom of mobility within the common market, so Britain wouldn't be required to take an unlimited amount of European migrants. Some they might actually introduce some caps for individual countries or for the European Union as a whole. I think it is possible to find some common ground, and they should really find some common ground and a compromise in all of this, because if both Britain and the European Union basically shut each other out because they can't find an agreement, it will be really a disastrous affair for both of them, because Britain needs Europe, of course. It's Britain's most important export market. And conversely, of course, many European countries need Britain because, for example, I think there are currently about 18,000 cars that Britain imports from Germany. Now, these two blocks, Britain and the European Union, are mutually dependent. they should find a compromise, even if it means compromising on some of the principles of the common market.
How difficult do you believe these negotiations will be, and how will you characterise the atmosphere in which they will be conducted in? Because obviously, as we know, divorces can either be very acrimonious or they can be settled. What do you think will be the climate of the negotiation at this point?
Well, Jean-Claude Juncker, the president of the European Commission, said it won't be an amicable divorce, but then again, it was a very passionate love affair in the first place.
Yeah.
He probably has a point there. I think the tone of the negotiations will probably also depend on the next British Prime Minister. If it becomes Boris Johnson, of course, Boris, as one of the leaders, of course, of the Vote Leave campaign, will find it quite hard, actually, to convince his European colleagues to give him any kind of concessions, because they will see him as a traitor to the European project and they will treat him like one. But nevertheless, I think in the end, economic rationality should prevail. Everybody should realize what's at stake, and there simply can't be an interest in having a long, acrimonious process in these divorce negotiations, because it is in nobody's interest to wreck Britain and lead to reduced exports from the Eurozone to Britain.
I'm wondering how you're characterising Boris Johnson. We know he's a scholar of Winston Churchill. Do you think he is trying to emulate him?
Well, I think he probably would like to, but then again, David Cameron tried the same. He also referred to Winston Churchill in one of the referendum debates. That didn't really help him too much, did it? I know Boris Johnson personally. I used to work in London for a think tank that was quite closely linked to the Conservative Party, and I met Boris Johnson on a number of occasions. I think he's certainly an intellectual heavyweight, but he hides it really well, sometimes behind this buffoonery and colourful haircut and some grandiose rhetoric. But actually, Boris Johnson is a serious thinker. He is a good intellectual, and of course, he's got some really intelligent people around him. Think of Michael Gove, whom I also know quite well. When I worked at Policy Exchange in London, Michael for a time was my chairman, and I worked quite closely with him. These people are not clowns, as they are sometimes portrayed in the media. They're actually quite serious politicians, and I think quite good intellectuals as well. I think the negotiations on Britain's exit from the European Union would be in quite good hands with Boris Johnson, Michael Gove, and potentially also with George Osborne, if he stays on maybe as Foreign Secretary. So I think they will have a very good team to lead Britain through these troubled times the next couple of years while they're negotiating with Brussels.
There has been this suggestion that Boris Johnson's heart wasn't necessarily in the Leave camp, that it was done for political purposes. Do you go along with that?
To a degree. Boris Johnson has always been quite Eurosceptical, I would say. If you go back through the archive of his columns that he wrote for the Daily Telegraph, you can definitely find that Boris was intimately aware of the failings of the European Union. And of course, he used to be a correspondent for the Daily Telegraph in Brussels and followed European politics quite closely. So he certainly wasn't a Euro enthusiast. He was always quite sceptical. I think it was coming down to a very tight decision for him whether to support membership of the European Union because of all the turmoil that Brexit would create, or following probably his heart that Britain would probably be better off as a nation governing itself. But then again, if you look at David Cameron, I mean, David Cameron was not a glowing EU enthusiast either. He just happened to find himself on that side of the debate because he was the incumbent prime minister, and it would have been very awkward for him to campaign for Brexit. So I think both David Cameron and Boris Johnson, under different circumstances, could have found themselves in arguing quite different positions. That's just the way it played out. I think in reality, both are probably quite as Eurosceptic as each other, but one happened to be in office and the other one wanted to have that office.
Now, I know it's crystal ball gazing from this point, trying to really begin to assess what the likely pathway for Britain is, so many unknowns. But if we were to just consider for a moment what that outcome might look like in 5 years' time, what is it going to require for, obviously, the outcome that Boris Johnson believes in, that this vote will actually be a positive for Britain? And what do you believe is potentially going to hamper that outcome?
Well, let's just assume that Britain will actually pull out of the European Union, because I'm not quite convinced that this is certain at this stage. That requires Article 50 of the European Treaty being triggered, but it is by no means certain that we'll get to that point, because there might be another election in the way which might be an opportunity to overturn the referendum results. So I'm not 100% convinced quite yet that we will actually see a formal withdrawal from the European Union. But anyway, let's just assume for now that it actually happens, that it would probably happen sometime over the next couple of years, maybe 3 years, depending on how long these negotiations take. Well, if Britain manages to play this game well, and if the European Union doesn't just want to punish Britain and still grants it some access to European markets, then I actually see a chance that in 5 or 6 years' time, Britain would have come out of this as a stronger nation, because there are a few positives as well that will materialize, but only over the next few years. One of the positives is, of course, that Britain will be able to conduct its own trade negotiations. Currently, of course, as a member of the European Union, it's part of the European Union bloc. It doesn't negotiate its own trading conditions with the rest of the world, but it's dependent on whatever the European Commission negotiates. So currently, for example, there is an ongoing debate about a free trade agreement between the EU and the UK. Now, that may happen, it may be delayed, but Britain can't influence it. Once Britain is out, of course, Britain would be free to approach the New Zealand government and conduct these negotiations probably much faster than the EU could, because let's face it, there are no French farmers in Britain, so it would probably be a lot easier for New Zealand and the UK to find some common ground on a free trade agreement than it is for New Zealand and the EU as a whole. In the same way, the UK could also seek trade deals with other countries. And the astonishing thing is, of course, if you're looking around the world, there are plenty of countries, smaller countries, that have vastly more trade deals and more valuable trade deals than the European Union currently does. So Britain, as a nation standing on its own two feet, that no longer bound by European Union rules, could actually start negotiating trade deals left, right and center. I think one of the first countries would be New Zealand, but other countries would be, for example, Australia, it might be China, could be the US. South Korea has already said that they would like to do one of the first FTAs with Britain once it's out of the EU. So that's one of the advantages for Britain. The other one is, of course, that it wouldn't be bound by European regulations any longer, so it could actually try to get rid of the most growth-stifling regulations and become a much more free market, free trading country than any of its European neighbors. So I think in the long term, there are quite a few good chances for Britain if it plays it well. In the short term, of course, there is enormous turmoil and there's a lot of political uncertainty.
Now, if we think about the historical significance of all of this, there's rich irony around the fact that when Britain entered the European community back in 1973, that dealt quite a severe blow to the New Zealand economy. Is it possible that that trade relationship at some point might be able to get back to what it was 50 or 60 years later?
Not quite. I think we will not see a return to the 1970s, where New Zealand at one stage exported about half or more than half of its goods to Britain. That won't happen simply because we've seen other countries rise in the meantime, and so we are now talking about the Indian and the Chinese market, the Southeast Asian nations that New Zealand has actually developed as export markets. So even if Britain and New Zealand became much closer again, I think we are not going to see a return to the 1970s with, you know, 50 or 60% of our exports going there. Having said that, I think there is, of course, every possibility of increasing our exports to Britain again, because you mentioned the 1970s, 1973, that was a really difficult time for New Zealand when it lost its main export market after Britain joined the EEC. There is a good chance to return the trading relationship with Britain to something that we had in the 1970s, so much more liberal, much more free trading. And in fact, if Boris Johnson becomes Prime Minister, this is quite likely to happen, because Boris Johnson has for a long time been an advocate of increased trading relationships between Britain and its former colonies in the Commonwealth. And only last year he emphasized that point again, and he once again supported the idea even of not just a free trade agreement between Britain and Australia and New Zealand, but even a free labour mobility agreement between the countries. So he thinks there should be a common labour market for Britons, New Zealanders and Australians. So that would be quite interesting.
And just finally, of course, the EU has been unable to forge a plan that would fix unemployment in southern Europe and revive the stagnant economy. The EU's founding treaty promised prosperity. It's failed. Germany has the healthiest economy in Europe, but even it struggles to grow. If you were assigning a mark out of 10 to the project to this point, what would you be giving it?
Very difficult to just give one mark to the European projects. As I said, there were some elements of it that were very laudable and that definitely deserve to be supported, such as removing trade barriers, integrating European markets, increasing competition. That's all very well. I think where the European Union has really failed is post, 1993, or basically starting with the Treaty of Maastricht, moving this European economic community towards a political union and then introducing things for which Europe simply wasn't ready. European Monetary Union is perhaps the prime example. Also, of course, at the same time that it was trying to deepen the European Union by leading it towards a more political union, widening it by inviting Central and Eastern European economies to join, I think that was probably too much to deal with for the European Union all at once. In the 1990s, I think the strategic mistake was to do both deepening and widening at the same time. They should have probably just focused on making sure that Eastern and Central European countries could join the EEC, and the deepening, I think, just came way too early when most European countries simply were not ready for that. So I think on that front, the political union aspect, the European Monetary Union aspect, the European Union over the last 20 years has been an unmitigated disaster. It didn't work, doesn't work, it doesn't create growth, and especially European Monetary Union has been a gigantic and very costly mistake.
Well, that's our program for today. A reminder, if you'd like to get in touch with us, we welcome your comments and feedback. Our email address is sundaybusiness@nbr.co.nz. And if you'd like to follow me on Twitter, it's AndrewP_NZ. I do hope you can join me again next time for another edition of Sunday Business here on NBR Radio.
Sunday Business with Andrew Patterson, every Sunday on NBR Radio, and also available as a free downloadable podcast from iTunes. Just go to NBR Radio, look for Sunday Business.